RadioInfluence.com.
You know her from network radio, but now she's on the net and in your head.
Don't believe me, just watch.
This is the Fabulous Sports Babe on RadioInfluence.com.
You know what? I'm on this podcast again. I don't know why, but I keep showing up here. I figure it doesn't make me crazy, so I've done it. How long this is going to last, I don't know, but I still show up doing all of that. I've got a lot of things to talk about. A lot of it has to do with football. And I don't want to say anything, but what is that, the MCL, the ACL? The ACL is bad, isn't it? It's like your Achilles goodbye. It's like every time I turn around, somebody's got horrible things going on with them. And I get that it's football. I get all of that. But there's a lot of that medial, lateral, ACL stuff going on in all of that. I did watch a whole bunch of things. And I got to be honest, I love the Patriots. Everybody said, is anything going to happen with Denver? I mean, is anything going to happen with Miami? None of that happened at all. I have many things that are coming up. And now I'm getting to the point when I look at these games and I go, do I care about any of these teams? And you know what I thought was interesting? I thought Cincinnati, once again, I understood that Ben was back, but I didn't think they'd win that game. And that team was really good again. And I keep thinking to myself, Denver's really good, I guess. I mean, and New England is still good. And I'm thinking at these things, I'm thinking, okay, they're going to have to play the Giants. I'm not worried about the Giants. I'm talking about New England in the middle of this. And nobody makes me crazy. They do finish, however, with the Jets and at the Dolphins, which we'll have to see. In all of that, I sort of, you know, I'm a fan. I really want them to win all the games. I doubt that that will happen, but it's kind of made me a little bit nuts. In all of that, we're going to talk a bunch of baseball coming up today. Mel Antonin's going to join us. He's a guy I've known for such a very long time. He's at Mid-Atlantic Sports Network in New York. He covers the Nationals and the Orioles. Longtime American League Baseball writer for USA Today. And I remember when he was there for like 20-some-odd years, and I'm looking at the paper or whatever it is that day, and it's like there's only one person left and everybody else got fired. And so I immediately write to him and go, are you all right? And he said, I'm just trying to process it. I don't really know what happened. I've never gotten fired. I thought, oh, for God's sakes, I've been fired a million times. What are you talking about? Every place I wanted to go was to get to a new job, so I had to get fired all the time. And I was like, I understand. It must have been horrible when you're someplace for 20-some-odd years and you get fired and you don't know what to do. I get that. But, you know, he's gonna join us because he's really good. He's been at the World Series. We will talk to him a lot about that because let's be serious about Kansas City. We like the Mets fine, but Kansas City was on some type of roll. And when I looked at what happened last year and they lost, I remember that pop-up that went to in the Giants, and I stood there and looked at what happened, and then I thought, they're going to come back, but I never thought they'd be back again. And I thought to myself, you know what? It's the Mets in Kansas City. When are you going to get over it? And they just go along. And one of the things that I'll tell him about is about Ned Yost. He made a very good comment about them at the very beginning of that. So we will talk with him. We'll talk a lot about the World Series and what we think of that. We'll talk a lot about the Orioles and also about the Nationals. And one of the things that I did want to ask him was about Grantland and the fact that Grantland they say goodbye to. And I guess it means you're supposed to yell and scream at people. And I thought, well, gee, I made a pretty good living doing that over there. So I guess I can't complain about it. But all those things are coming up. We will talk to Mel Antonin. Love him, love him. You're going to love everything about the World Series. Let's do it. Let's talk about the World Series, because it was 4-1, you know, and I saw that one game and I thought, oh, the Mets are going to come back. And I thought it was really interesting that Ned Yost said when they got the two runs in the bottom of the ninth, he said, I knew that was it. I knew we would win this game.
Yeah, there was no question how confident the Royals were. I talked to Dale Swain, the Royals batting coach, before game 3 in New York, and he said this team has been confident all year, but he said he'd never seen them this confident as they were in the postseason. This is a team that didn't hit a lot of home runs, and yet they provided a lot of dramatics in the postseason. I mean, isn't it bizarre that all the times they came back in the World Series, only one home run was memorable? They only hit one home run, Alex Gordon. The rest were doubles, singles, stolen bases, daring daring dashes from third, all that type of stuff. The Royals were the only team in the American League who didn't strike out 1,000 times. And you could see in the postseason why they were so tough.
Well, one of the things is if you look at them, especially if you're a National League and you don't follow the American League, you're like, well, they don't do anything. There's not a big home run. There's not three home runs or anything like that in the seventh inning. But they pitch well. They hit the ball. They go from first to second. That's what they do. And they come in. And, you know, I have this thing. I have no idea if it means anything. It's just me. But I find it in football and also in baseball that if a team goes to, like, the NL Championship and loses, they want to go back there and take that and move on to the World Series. Same thing with football. But it's not that often that you get back the next year, really. You know,
no,
and
I mean,
so they came back and did the same thing. They went to the World Series, they lost to the Giants, and they went back and they just grabbed it.
Exactly. The 60 and 61 Yankees. I think the Yankees, they lost the Game 7 in 1960 and ended up winning in 1961 the World Series. Oakland lost 1 year and then won the next year in the 80s. But or lost 1 year and then won in the 80s. Yeah, they lost to the Giants in 88 and then won in 89. But, yeah, you know, last year when the Royals made it to the seventh game of the World Series, everybody said they were just a one-year wonder.
Yeah.
And, boy, they came into spring training with an incredible chip on their shoulder and said, we're going to show the baseball world how good we were in 2014 and that what we did last year wasn't a fluke. And, boy, they did. And what's interesting about the Royals is they made no bones about their strategy. Get the starters to pitch five or six, maybe six innings, but five for sure, mm-hmm. and then just turn it over to the best bullpen in the league. And even though they lost one of their key bullpen members in closer Greg Holland, elbow injury, they were still lights out. It really is an incredible story when you think about how good the Royals bullpen was at a time when bullpens are hard to build.
Well, and, you know, one of the things, and you said that thing about five innings, and they'll give it to Duffy, they'll give it to Davis, whatever they want to do with that. So it's not give me seven innings and we'll bring somebody in the eighth and the ninth. It's a little bit longer than that, but we feel comfortable about what's going on in the bullpen.
Yeah, and I think they lost Greg Hall in the closer, but Wade Davis more than made up for him. Calvin Herrera moved from the seventh to the eighth inning, and then they had Ryan Matson take over the seventh, and they had Luke Hochschaver, a former number one pick as a starter. They just had so many weapons. And I think the difference then in the World Series, obviously, the general consensus before the World Series started was that the Mets and the Royals, or the Royals have such better bullpen arms than the Royals. There's so many more questions and concerns in the Mets bullpen.
You know,
and that theory and that consensus yes. turned out to be true in the World Series.
You know, when I saw it at the very beginning, I kind of really didn't pay any attention because I thought, well, they got rid of James Shields, so they don't have anybody. And all of a sudden I thought, well, they're really there. I'm sitting in September going, Kansas City's really there, aren't they? And they just, it was almost to go back to the place where they lost and win it. That's all I could think of. I see that sometimes in football. I see it a lot in baseball. It just doesn't happen so much. And I thought, okay, Shields is gone. I understand that Davis is there, but I thought, well, they won't have anybody. They had everybody they needed.
They really did, and you know, and Shields was a good 200-inning guy who was a good leader, but Edison Volquez has learned to throw on both sides of the plate with excellent command, and so that's why he was tough. Yordano Ventura, who was their opening day starter, ended up in the minor leagues, or would have gone to the was supposed to go to the minor leagues to fix some pitching issues, but ended up coming back because Jason Vargas got hurt. And Danny Duffy is a young kid, and then you had Chris Young. It seemed like there were so many questions in the Royals' rotation, and I think there was. I mean, it isn't a bunch of Cy Young candidates, and it isn't a bunch of young rookies like the Mets had, but boy, they pitched very well. And even though Salvador Perez, their catcher, was the MVP of the World Series, it could have easily been Edison Volquez, given how well he pitched in the face of grieving about his death, about the death of his father.
You know, we all talked about that, Mel, and I wonder, I gather that they weren't saying anything, but I guess it was on Twitter and wherever, that he had passed away, but he didn't really know about it till afterwards or while he was pitching is when they told him afterwards. How did that work out for him?
Well, nobody was sure. I mean, the report basically was that he did not know the night that he was pitching. But Alcides Escobar, the Royal shortstop, was telling reporters afterward that he had talked to Edison Volquez about his father's death before the game. So I think the best guess scenario was that Volquez knew, but he didn't want to tell the Royals because he didn't want them to think that he was going to be distracted. He didn't want to do anything to hurt his team's chances. Mm-hmm. I think that's what he thought his father's wishes would have been. But I just from reading various reports, it feels like Volquez knew and kept it quiet because he just didn't want it to be a distraction. Mm-hmm. And he certainly didn't want to be taken out of the game and do that to the Royals, especially since it was the start of the series.
Do we look at the Mets and go, maybe this was just a year too early? Or what happens with Murphy and people like that? What's going to happen now with the Mets? Because I wonder if they sort of got to the World Series but weren't really thinking of getting there for a couple more years.
I don't think they were thinking of getting there for a couple more years. But, you know, at the end of July, toward the end of July, when they had the best pitching staff, the best starting staff in the National League, I think they thought, hey, let's get some bats mm-hmm. here and see what we can do. Remember, before they picked up Cespedes, before they picked up Kelly Johnson and Juan Uribe, they were the worst run-producing team in the National League before the All-Star break. After the All-Star break, they were the best run-producing team in the National League. And then when you throw in DeGrom, Harvey, Syndergaard, Cologne, Mats, you can see why they won. It helped, of course, that the Nationals fell apart and imploded, but they beat the Nationals they went 6-for-6 against the Nationals in the second half of the season. So the Mets were no fluke, and the question will be how much can that young pitching bounce back next year? But you would think that they were going to be all right. This is the only team in a long, long time that had five starters aged 27 or younger. Mm-hmm. Jacob DeGrom was the oldest Mets pitcher there at 27. Reminds you of the 2010 Giants when they had Lincecum, Sanchez, Matt Cain, Madison Bumgarner, and those guys. but it's not very often you have this many young pitchers in a rotation pitching this well.
And one of the things I noticed is they seem to all throw at 100 miles an hour, and when you hit it, it goes way out of the park like to the moon. I mean, I just, every one of them is 99, 100, just throwing them in left and right like that. And I'm like, as long as nobody gets bad Tommy John surgery, they're going to be fine.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, another pitcher they have that's waiting in the wings is Zach Wheeler, a very elite pitcher. He's coming back from Tommy John next year. He missed this year because of the surgery. But, yeah, you know, Jacob DeGrom proved in the division series against the Dodgers that he can win without his best stuff. And that was probably the best news that the Mets could ever have. Yeah, it's nice to throw 99 to 100, mm-hmm. but if you don't have that, and if you don't have the command of your fastball, you got to find ways to win. And Syndergaard proved that he can do that, and DeGrom can do that, and Harvey can do that.
Well, it was pretty amazing, and they all said, oh, he should have taken him out after when Harvey came out, and everybody was glad that he was there. They should have taken him out here and there. You know what? The guy wanted to come out. He was the guy. You're sitting at the Mets. You might as well go with him. And they can say, well, when he walked the first guy, you had to get rid of him. And I thought, you know, it happens. It happens. That's all. I didn't find it to be horrible. Yeah.
Yeah, it would have been a gamble to bring in the bullpen again, too, with the way the bullpen was pitching. Jerry Familia would not say that his confidence was shot, but there was reason to believe that it was. Matt Harvey's mechanics were strong. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he had 102 pitches, but I agree with you, Sports Babe. The best way to win that game was to have Matt Harvey start the ninth. And he got ahead of Lorenzo Cain, but then he walked him, and that's when the trouble began.
It did begin, too. And I go back to what I said at the very beginning when Ned Yost said, we scored two runs in the ninth, and I knew we had it. And I thought, that's pretty ballsy to say something like that. Because they knew it. You know what I mean? They really, he said, that's the way they've been since we went to spring training. That's the way they've been the whole time.
Yeah. I think what this proves is that you know, in an era where everybody's striking out 150, 175 times, it's nice to have a team that makes a lot of contact and gets on base a lot. Certainly the Royals have power. They have a lot more power than they had last year. But in the postseason, when you're playing against great teams and the best pitching staffs in the league, it's easier for a good pitching staff to shut down a team that relies on power than it is for a good pitching staff to shut down a team that relies on, you know, contact hitting mm-hmm. and all that. So that's what made the Royals tough. I mean, The Mets had a lot of power pitching, but the Royals wore them down. And the Royals of 2015 remind everybody a lot of the 2002 Angels with Troy Glass and Tim Salmon and those guys. Those guys were impossible to get out in 2002. Ask the Minnesota Twins in the American League Championship Series. And that's what the 2015 Royals remind me of.
Well, I think it would be interesting because we get to see it and we'll think about 4-1 and it'll go away for a while and then we'll think about more about that. I thought it was really good. I love the Cubs. Of course, I love Joe Maddon. I love the fact that the Astros were in it. I just thought it was great that they were there for a day or two. At least they got involved in it. And now we have, I guess we can't go without talking about the fact that Dusty Baker is the new manager of the Nationals. And I don't think people were thinking that a day ago.
No, they weren't. I mean, it was pretty much well reported, including every outlet in Washington, that Buddy Black was going to be the new manager of the Nationals. But apparently, there were some contract issues with Black and the Nationals, and Dusty Baker came aboard. So, either way, whether it was Black or Dusty Baker, the Nationals got what they want in a manager, and that is a lot of experience and a lot of credibility. Dusty Baker gives them that. And, you know, you got to wonder, would Dusty Baker still be managing the Cincinnati Reds if they hadn't lost that 2012 Division Series to the Giants? Remember, the Reds won the first two games in San Francisco and then lost three in a row at home to the Giants. And, of course, the Giants went on to win the World Series. But you got to wonder if that would have been the case.
You know, one of the things, I mean, I don't really, one of the things I understood, let me just see if I can say this right, that Bud Black wanted X, and they gave him half of that, and that's sort of what happened with Dusty Baker. Like, he got half, but a whole bunch of incentives. Is that right?
Yeah, it sounds like that's the case. Still trying to figure all that out, but yeah. And Buddy wanted just more money, and Baker was satisfied with the contract. Dusty Baker wants to win a World Series ring. He came very close in 2012. He hit a very good team in 2012 with the Reds. And then he lost the World Series in 2002 when he was managing the Giants. So, you know, money probably wasn't the first and foremost issue with Dusty Baker. I'm not sure what happened with the negotiations with Buddy Black, but Baker wants to win, and, you know, he's a very good manager.
So let me just talk to you a little bit more about things, because you've been doing this Mid-Atlantic Sports Network. You've been covering the Orioles and the Nationals. Do you like doing that? And is it different from what you did before now? Because it seems like at the time when we thought nobody's going to have a newspaper in another year, and now it's all come back, but you are doing a different thing. Now you write for Mets and you write for other things, and it's a different, almost like a circle that's come back for you.
Yeah, I'm a little more local than I used to be. I covered the American League and National Baseball for 25 years at USA Today, so I was constantly all over the country. And the biggest difference now that I'm on the Orioles and the Nationals TV network, is that I'm a little bit more local. That doesn't mean I don't follow the national scene. I do. I do, in fact, because I do some shows on Sirius XM. But basically, my job has changed somewhat as a reporter in it, you know, looking more Orioles and Nationals. And instead of traveling to 100 games a year, 110 games a year like I used to with USA Today, I'm pretty much in Baltimore at Camden Yards when the Orioles are home, and I'm at Nats Park when the Nationals are home in D.C. It's refreshing. It's a refreshing change, and it's refreshing simply because it's different, and yet it's still baseball.
You know, one of the things, when I had this conversation, I talked with Leslie Visser, I was talking with Christine Brennan about it too, and you're the same way, that no matter what, you are a writer. No matter what TV and all that stuff, you are a writer, right?
Oh, I think so. I miss writing day to day. You know, I was at the World Series over the weekend in New York, and you know, it is a grind to be a writer, there's no question. But at times I do really miss it. I miss the access. I miss the camaraderie with the players. I miss trying to find new stories and trying to tell stories behind the stories. But you know, this is awfully fun too. It's fun for different reasons. Mm-hmm. But yeah, writing is always first and foremost the ideal job in baseball.
But it seems to me that whenever you were, let's say, with USA Today, and then you thought, well, I have to do this and do that, but it sort of has come back to you do get to write again, and you do. It's just in a different format because we just have a different format of what we're doing now.
Exactly. The platforms have changed. There's no question about that. And you don't know how long it's going to be till newspapers just die completely. I mean, it was amazing how many dot-com people were in the press box at the World Series this year as opposed to traditional daily newspapers. I think dot-coms outnumbered the traditional newspapers at the World Series, and that's just the way we're going. The platforms are different. I write a lot of TV scripts now, and, you know, actually my USA Today training where stories were 5, 6, 7, 10 inches, in a lot of ways I feel like I've got a lot of experience writing bright, tight, and short, given my USA Today background. But it's fun to write for TV, but then you always have to remember the video and mix in there, and, you know, I'm still learning a lot there.
But it's good that you're doing it, and it's kind of fun, right? Do you like doing this? I mean, is it hard for you, or was it easy to go into Mass and to do the Mid-Atlantic Sports Network? Was it hard for you, or was that easy?
No, it was a bit of a transition. I mean, the people there were helping me out. I just had to learn to speak and not look at my notes. I had to learn to be prepared, and go from there. But I had some experience in TV. I worked at ESPN for 1 year. I did a baseball show on CNN back in the 90s. But it takes a little bit different. It's a little bit different setup in that sometimes you only have 30 seconds to say something, and you got to learn to talk in sound bites. And, you know, but once you get a lot of practice at it and once you get a lot of instruction, you know, I think I do it well.
Mel, what's your thought on what happened with Grantland this week?
Well, it's sad. It's sad because I think the journalism world is moving away from storytelling. It feels like that the journalism world now wants yellers and screamers and opinions and sharp comments, sometimes out of line comments, in place of good old-fashioned storytelling. Grantland told stories. Grantland had legitimate reporters, experienced reporters, telling stories and putting events into perspective. And it feels like in this internet age, nobody wants that. And I think the fact that Grantland went out of business is a snapshot of that, is a result of that. It's very, very sad because I don't think people are reading enough. I think people are more interested in a quick opinion, a wise guy remark, and something to fight about as opposed to just a really good story. And Grantland was always good reading.
You know, I wonder about that, too, and I think you're right about, you know, we'd rather see it on Twitter. We'd rather see something in Facebook in a heartbeat to be talking about it. It doesn't seem, I think what you said about Grantland is really good because it is going a different way. You know what I was thinking about? I was thinking about when you and I first did. And you know what? It's very weird. I remember this. The first time you and I sat down, and it was at a Reds game. That's how long ago it was. And
wow.
You and I sat down, and I talked to you. And I didn't even know if you'd been on the radio before, but we talked at that time. And that was really a long time ago. And I thought, it's so different. And it's not even in the last 20 years. It's really been in the last 5 years that things have changed so much. And like you said, more dot-com people are sitting in the press room.
Yeah, they really are. It's different in that I think there's a genuine lack of respect for reporting in the higher ranks, whether it's TV, radio, and newspapers. I came from newspapers, and it was, you know, in the first 10 or 15 years of my career at USA Today, it was all about doing the story properly. But in the last 10 years, thanks to the internet, it was always just let's get it out, let's be first, let's get hits. And it's changed. It's changed. And I think there's a real lack of respect for good reporting skills. And maybe that'll all come back. But right now, that's not the case. Just about anybody can start a website and throw up a bunch of opinions and get into a bunch of internet arguments. And it's kind of sad to see that because good old-fashioned reporting should not be lost in the shuffle.
You know, one of the things about that that just reminds me that now you used to have, you know, you need three sources. Now two of them are your grandmother. It's perfectly okay. Do you know?
Exactly. I mean, it's there's no no accountability for making errors. There is, you know, throw enough stuff on the wall and eventually something will stick. But, yeah, it's there's just such a need to get so much information out that, you know, in the area of good reporting, you know, that good, I think good, honest reporting gets lost in the shuffle. And in my final years in newspapers, it was like, let's have an edge to this story. And if you didn't have an edge to this story, an editor would put an edge in your story. And you'd read it the next day and you'd go, what is going on? I didn't say that, and I certainly don't think that. But in a lot of ways, that's what's happening to the journalism business. Not just in sports, but in politics and money and everything else. I mean, it's it is amazing the lack of reporting, the respect for lack of good reporting.
Let me ask you about the Papelbaum and Harper thing. Tell me about that. At one point, he just grabbed him, and everybody said, get rid of him, which they did. What happened with the Nats in that?
Well, it was a frustrating season. And Jonathan Papelbaum, you know, he wants to be in the playoffs like everybody else. And so when Bryce Harper hit a fly ball against the Philadelphia Phillies at home in D.C., Harper didn't run all the way to first base. And or he jogged there. He didn't stop running, but he didn't run very quickly, and that drove Papelbon crazy. So Papelbon started hollering at him, and that was fine. And, I mean, an experienced player telling a young player to hustle, probably not the end of the world. But when Harper got to the dugout, Papelbon went after him and actually put him in a chokehold. It was an amazing scene, and it was an amazing. I mean, who would have ever thought that two players would get into a? I mean, players have gotten in scuffles. But having one player, you know, choke another player, wow, that's what that was what made this really strange. And also what made it very strange is Matt Williams, the Nats manager, pretended like he didn't even know what was going on.
And that's why he got fired, or at least that's one of the reasons for that. Do you, and let me ask you about the Orioles, because we talk a lot about the Nets, but you're used to covering the American League, and you're used to seeing that team, and they always say, are they going to get rid of this guy or do that guy? I like the Orioles. I don't know why, but for the last 5 years, I've always liked that team for some reason.
Well, they're a good team. They're a good defensive team. One of the best in the American League. That's why they won the division in 2014. They had good pitching lined up coming into the season. If they had pitched in 2015 like they had pitched in 2014, especially the second half, Sports Babe, they would have run away with the division in the American League East. But the pitching let them down. The rotation let them down big time. Bud Norris was a bust. Chris Tillman didn't pitch well. Kevin Gausman was a little too young. They just had a lot of issues in their rotation that they weren't expecting. They did have one of the best bullpens in the American League. Their defense was incredibly strong, if not the best in the league. And they certainly had enough run production, even though they had lost Nelson Cruz and Nick Markakis. But the starting pitching was faltered big time, fell apart. And that was the one thing that the Orioles didn't think was going to happen. So they've got to rebuild a little bit. They've got to figure out what to do with their pitching staff. They've got a ton of free agents, including Chris Davis. And one of their best pitchers, Wei-Yin Chen. So they got some work to do, but they're not going anywhere unless they fix that pitching staff.
You know, I have to tell you this because I'm thinking about the Orioles, and I go to someplace that doesn't make any sense, but it's okay. I have to tell you, the whole time that he was out of baseball because the Yankees didn't want A-Rod in there for a whole year, he obviously was taking some type of television thing because he was terrific. During Fox, he was spectacular, I thought, throughout the whole series. I mean, I just thought he was terrific throughout the whole playoffs and into the World Series. Did you see any of that?
Yes, I did, and I agree with you on that. I know Alex Rodriguez has had his problems with PEDs and lying and lawsuits and all that. And I know that, you know, he got what he deserved and all that, and I realize his credibility is shot. But the one thing you can't take away from A-Rod Sports, and I know you know from covering him, he is a fan of the game. He's not just, I mean, he plays hard and he works hard and he plays for himself and all that. He's very concerned with what he and his team does. but he is a fan of the game, and you can tell that by the way he. But you've hung out with him in the clubhouse. Mm-hmm. You know how he is. He loves to talk baseball, just like any other fan over a beer in a bar. And I think his commentary on Fox came out. It's almost like he forgot that he was on television, and he was just talking to you as if you guys were at dinner together or something. I thought he did a great job, but I'm not surprised because for all the troubles he's had, he does have passion for the game.
Do you know, I'm so over PEDs now, I don't really care. I mean, I get what they're doing, but to me, it was so long ago. I mean, it really was over 10 years ago, and I don't really care anymore because I think whatever they're doing right now is just way ahead of whatever they have testing it right now anyway.
Yeah, they got it. You know, you're right. I'm over PEDs as well, but it's one of those things that you have to watch out for. Yeah, it would be irresponsible to just say the PED era is over with, but it'd also be irresponsible not to even suspect or always have it in the back of your mind. But right now, you're right. I mean, I think the good chemist or the bad chemist will always be a step or two ahead of the good chemist. But, you know, there is a testing program in place, and as long as they make incremental improvements on it, I don't think we have to worry too much about PEDs, although it's something you always got to watch out for.
I think you're the only person I know that comes from South Dakota. You may be the only person I ever met that came from South Dakota, and I was most. And I thought, you know what? I'm one of the. For people who don't know, I grew up in the Air Force, and we went everywhere. And I've been to every state in the whole world, and to Europe, and all that. But I've been through South Dakota and North Dakota. But I said, you're the only person I ever knew that came from South Dakota. You
I
really
hear
are.
That all the time.
Well, because we're all like, where? But he is.
That's true. Well, there are some famous South Dakota baseball players. Sparky Anderson came from South Dakota. Dick Green grew up in South Dakota. You know, Dick Green from the 70s,
yes.
Early 70s, second baseman for the world champion A's three consecutive years. He grew up in South Dakota. So there's been a few. Dave Collins from South Dakota. So.
Well, see, I have visions of you on a farm and stuff like that. Did you grow up in that or not at all? I just have some.
Oh,
kind
yeah,
of-
I did. I grew up in a small town of about 380 people. My dad and I, well, we had about 400 acres of cropland, and we raised about 75 head of cattle a year. I fed cattle all winter, all summer. I baled hay.
No wonder you went to Washington.
Baseball. What's that?
No wonder you went to Washington.
I knew a lot about manure, so that's when I moved to Washington.
That was really good because I thought to myself, I got to figure that out, but I've known that for a while. I love talking with you. It was so good to hear you again. Thank you so much for getting it together and talking with us because it was really great this time. Thank you so much.
Well, as always, I love working with you, and I appreciate you having me on, and we'll talk again soon.
You know what's the best thing about it is to really understand the World Series, the way that he brings it out to you. Mel Anton was absolutely terrific in the middle of that. I'm glad that you're getting the chance to see him. I love talking to him if you want to know all of that. I've got football. My Ohio State's going to beat up somebody. What is it, Minnesota or somebody this week? I don't care. Just keep beating them up. That's all I want to know. I got a bunch of games coming up, and I was talking to you about Cincinnati. Well, Cincinnati's got the Cleveland Browns. I don't think that's going to be too hard. In the middle of that, and the Jets got their asses kicked. Ooh, against Oakland, and they've got the Jacksonville coming. I don't want to say, but they're going to kill Jacksonville. I could be the quarterback there. Do they have a quarterback at all? The guy's got a broken something, and the other one's, I don't know what's going on with that. Anything else that's going on? A lot of people are getting rid of San Francisco. I don't want to say anything. Blaine Gabbert is your, I don't want to say anything, but he's Blaine Gabbert from Central Florida. Stop. Okay? I mean, if you win with him, we've got serious problems. In the middle of that, Denver at Indianapolis. I have to tell you, that game the other day, whatever that was, that Indianapolis came back and fought like crazy with Charlotte. I was kind of surprised about that. So Denver at Indianapolis is really not going to change at all. Please kill me if I try and do the Eagles. And who else? The Cowboys? I don't want to do any of that. I don't want to say anything, but it's already November. What the hell happened? It's like, Wasn't it July? And now it's November. Halloween. I hope you didn't do Halloween. I close the door and I turn off the lights and I go in the bedroom and close it. I don't want to talk to anybody. Do not come around here and ask me for anything. I have nothing. Leave me alone. That's all I want. In the middle of that, we will talk a lot about college football, a lot about baseball, because after all, those are the things I care about, especially at this time of the day. I love it when it does this stuff. Do I have to do this podcast again tomorrow? Oh, God's sake. I am the fabulous sports babe.
If you know the babe at all, you know this show never ends.
Don't believe me, just watch.
Follow her on Twitter at Real Sports Babe and subscribe to the show on iTunes. This is the Fabulous Sports Babe on Radio Influence.
This is Vincent Hill. You may have seen me on such shows as Dateline NBC, True Crime with Aphrodite Jones, or Nancy Grace. You may have also seen me on CNN. I'm very excited to say I'm bringing my brand new show, The Thin Blue Line, to Radio Influence. I'll be tackling all the top crime stories that the world is discussing, and I'll give you, the listeners, an in-depth analysis as to why it all happened. There are two lines to every story, the line between right and wrong, and the thin blue line with me, Vincent Hill, on Radio Influence.